Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. We have gathered brilliant people in the studio. Very, very smart indeed. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question, if you'd like to try to stump the band, that's always fun. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop. You can also comment on Facebook. It's Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. We'll have a Vox Pop post there. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us as well, VoxPop@WAMC.org. But by all means, call. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Now, with that said, let's meet our panel of experts, starting at my left and going clockwise.
Helen Giardella, Department of Biology, the University at Albany.
Helmut Hirsch, Professor Emeritus in Biology, the University at Albany, and more recently, living on a sustainable farm in Berksville, Kentucky, and learning a bit about farming.
And working on your accent.
Yeah, that's I haven't done a very good job on that.
Well, it's a work in progress. And we also have...
Ed Stander, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and nowhere near as smart as Ray thinks I am.
Well, you know, it's not in the script. I actually ad-libbed the brilliant part, but I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt here.
If you turn the lights off, you'll see none of us glow.
Fair enough. Well, the phone lines are loaded. And hopefully not the guests. Let's go to Lou in Altamont. Lou.
Yes, I have a 2-foot standing, freestanding heater, electric heater, that the heat comes out the top, and I wanted to put a shelf as close to the top of it as I can and reflect the heat back into the room at the same time while still keeping the functionality of the shelf. What material will work best on the bottom of the shelf, a piece of polished metal or a glass mirror?
Okay, that's a novel question.
It's not bad. What you're effectively doing when you put something over the top of the radiator is you're heating the metal, and it's giving off infrared. And the infrared is heat, so that's what's reflecting into your room. So anything that will absorb the material, absorb the heat, and then give it off again effectively is good. And for my book, I would say metal is better, certainly a better conductor than glass, which is because it's a much better conductor. Mm-hmm. So I would go with the metal and keep it far enough away from the wall so you're not heating the wall as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Lou, thank you very much. Anybody else want to weigh in here?
Well, just a quick comment. You didn't say what you're putting on the shelf. And I would think about the fact that whether what you put on the shelf is flammable. And there are regulations about how far things can be, stoves can be from the wall. For wood stoves, I don't know about electric stoves, but it might be worth checking to make sure you're not potentially creating a fire hazard.
A very prudent answer. Let's go to David in Munson. David, you're up.
Oh, hello. My question is, what is the temperature out in the middle of space?
All right.
It's approximately 3 degrees above absolute zero.
Everywhere, yeah?
Everywhere. Yeah, it's cold.
It's cold.
It's very cold. And the main reason for that is that there's so little material out in space that nothing heats up anything. So it stays very, very cold.
What accounts for those 3 degrees Kelvin?
It's called black body radiation. And effectively what's happening is, how can I say it? From the time of the Big Bang, when it was extremely hot, the universe has been cooling off. And as it cools off, it gives off radiation. We can measure that radiation. And the radiation that we're getting right now effectively is at about minus 3.1 degrees, something along that.
Okay, will there be a point where it's much closer to absolute zero?
It'll probably continue. As the universe expands, the temperature should go down, yeah.
Okay, David, great call. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Ed Stander, Helmut Hirsch, and Helen Giardella are here. I'm your host, your affable host, Ray Graff. No? All right. Betty in Albany. Betty.
Hi. I know that ironing is a thing of the past for a lot of people, but I have a thing that's been bugging me for years. Why is it that you can accidentally put a crease into something that you're ironing. Why can't you iron out that crease?
What is ironing? I'm sorry.
Come on, Ed. You know, you got to remember, he is a scientist. And,
geology, biology. I don't know if you're going to be able to get this one.
Well, I have a question, not an answer. When you do your ironing, have you moistened the material you're ironing? Because I learned this at home that, you know, you kind of...
No, I have a steam iron. You know, you can blast steam. And if you accidentally put a crease in, even if you blast it with steam, you cannot get that crease out.
And yet, next time you wash it, it's gone.
Yes.
So the being fully wet
will
clear that problem.
Yes, correct.
Well, I'm thinking that as you iron it, you're drying it out even more than it was before. And so it may be that when it's unironed, there's still enough moisture in there for it to reform itself as you dry it out by heating it. But that's just a guess at this point.
Right, yeah.
Would it be possible that the material it's made from has a certain kind of memory? We talk about materials having memories, and once you've really put a sharp crease into it, maybe that's enough of a change that you have to really stick it in the laundry again.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking.
To get that out. I used to iron handkerchiefs, and I'd get these creases all the time, and I never knew what to do with it.
Well, when you speak of memory, what do you mean? It can't really be memory.
Well, think about, for example, if you've got a metal wire and coat hangers, and you bend it and put a bend in it, you can't unbend it. It's basically changed.
I understand.
Colleagues maybe can answer why. What's changed?
Well, nothing's really changed in the material because you haven't bent it at a high enough pressure. You may have put what's called dislocations in it, but of course you don't do that in pants. You only do that in metals. I think it's a great question. I'm going to have to work on this one.
Hey, Betty, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
You know, I said it in jest at the top of the show. Well, if you have a laundry-related question, and there you go. Ask and ye shall receive.
What is this iron thing? Seriously, I mean.
Well.
Somebody take him to a museum somewhere. And
remember, ironing, we have a room full of scientists and a radio person. Ironing never really too high on that list.
Creases, yes.
Dick in Lake Champlain. Dick, you're on.
Yeah, hi. When I sneeze, it tends to be violent, and I always seem to sneeze in a series of seven. My children think that's very funny. But that makes it seem it's completely involuntary. But it only happens when I'm alone or at home and never seems to happen in public, which makes it sound voluntary. So which is it, voluntary or involuntary?
Well, I hate to speak up here, but I do exactly the same thing. And interestingly, my grandmother did the same thing as well. It skipped a generation.
Doing what?
Sneezing.
Counting sneezes?
Seven sneezes. Six to seven sneezes every time.
And what do you think it is?
I think it's genetic, in all honesty.
Don't you think that the act of counting the sneezes affects the experiment, so to speak?
I don't count the sneezes. I count the time. Because, I mean, I go on and on and on and on. It's a rough one because, of course, your eyes are closed every time you sneeze. And if I'm in a car and driving along, then I get four or five cars going by me before I can actually see them.
Yikes.
It's a major problem. But it is true that families who I shouldn't say that, sneeze together, this kind of thing does happen, and it's nothing to sneeze at.
But, Ed, but it's still not answering the question.
No, it's not.
Why are we sneezing?
I think it might actually be a genetic propensity to do it.
That's
your area, not mine.
Okay, now. All right, everybody calm down. All right, hang in there, Dick. We're going to get an answer for you right now.
Okay. My esteemed colleague is ignoring one of the things you said, which is that you do that at home, but when you're out being a little more, forgive me, civilized, then you can actually sneeze fewer times than you do at home. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So why would you have a genetic propensity
it's not the case
distinguishes with, between yes. being in company and being at home?
That's not the case with me, so I couldn't say that. I sneeze seven times no matter where I am. So he may be, you know, a mutation on what I have.
All right, Dick, he just called you a mutation.
I'm trying to think my way through this. And when I sneeze more than once, which is usually at least two or three times, the sneezing does stir up some of the mucus and so forth and so forth. And it may be that once that is stirred up, you have to sneeze more times in order to clear the passages and start all over again. And how much mucus you are producing and how easily it's being cleared with each sneeze and how many contaminants you're likely to get in to the nose, which is what's stimulating this in the first place. The confirmation of the nasal passages are certainly at least partly genetic. But
this
all
could
of this.
It could also be when you're with a group of people, you're more self-conscious about it, and
right.
so you don't
yeah.
do that.
So, but then you're saying his mucus production is a steady 7 sneeze.
Well, some people, yeah, again, and it, how it's wired up to the nervous system, which is controlling the patterning,
yeah.
may be an individual thing, but nevertheless.
Dick, are you more phlegmy at home?
I don't know. I think I'll take the mutation answer. I like that one.
All right,
better.
Fair enough. Hey, how's the weather up in Lake Champlain today?
Okay. Wait a minute. We said I asked
day.
Another
doable
question.
On the lake.
Okay, one more question.
One
follow
more
up.
Quick question. Since the sneezing is in response to something probably in the air, do you have, for example, cats or dogs at home or something else
yeah.
that would be an allergen? And we've kind of all heard at one point or another that indoor air is often more polluted than outdoor air. So perhaps there's something in your house that keeps the sneezing going, and you're outside and whatever that factor is less likely to be present.
Mm.
So okay. I don't know. That we'd have to investigate that.
All right, we're going to take a break here. I'm still puzzled as to why it's always 7. This is the real mystery for me. 1-800-348-2551 if you want to weigh in on the sneezing issue in Lake Champlain or whatnot. Give us a call.
Support for WAMC comes from Smith College Museum of Art, presenting The Eye is a Door, landscape photographs by Anne Whiston Spurn. Now on view, exhibition-related programs and more, smith.edu/artmuseum for details. Lexington Vacuum, Albany, New York, a local independent vacuum dealer of Miele, Sebo, Simplicity, Dyson, Electrolux, and more. Sales, service, repairs, lexivac.com. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. Kent Hicks Construction, West Chesterfield, Massachusetts, specializing in energy-efficient, net-zero, passive-house home building, deep energy retrofits, and historical restorations. Serving Western Massachusetts, kenthicksconstruction.com. And Oh My International Arts Center, Ghent, New York, presenting Music Oh My Concert featuring Fellows of Music Oh My. Saturday, August 2nd at 5 p.m., open to the public, artomy.org.
It's Vox Pop on WMC. Some snappy music for Science Forum here with Ray Graff and our scientists, Ed Stander, Helmut Hirsch, and Helen Giardella. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. So we were talking about sevens during the break, Helmut.
And in fact, there's a brilliant paper called The Magic Number 7, Plus or Minus 2, by Miller, and I don't know which of the three Millers it is anymore, from the 50s.
Glenn?
I don't think it was Glenn Miller.
'40s.
And what it states is that our sensory system, our nervous system, is in effect designed to take something that varies continuously, for example, weight, and we divide it into 7 categories, plus or minus 2, very tall, you know, less tall, whatever, short. The number of categories we choose seems to be something that's fixed in our nervous system. We don't sit there and say, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And one of my graduate students and I worked on something that in the literature they say are there 7 categories. We were at Albany, so we weren't quite that smart, and we used only 5 categories.
Ah.
So maybe the magic number 7 is, there's something real about it.
It's the key to the whole thing. Well, maybe if you want to weigh in on that at home, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go. Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you to the folks there for being willing to come and answer our questions here. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I have two questions. I don't know whether you'd like me to ask them one at a time or both up front, so I'll ask the first one. You let me know what. Is the burning that happens in producing CO2 itself adding a significant amount of heat to the atmosphere, or is the issue mostly or only about the absorption and retention of the heat that comes from the Earth and the sun?
Any CO2
now,
in the
atmosphere? Second question now.
Oh, go on.
Okay, that's question one. The other one, although some people claim that human activity can't affect the Earth's temperature, many people accept that cities are hotter in the summertime than surrounding suburban and rural areas because of the concrete, brick, and blacktop that absorb and hold the sun's heat. But these materials also retain colder temperatures longer than trees and grasses do. Does the same effect occur with CO2? In other words, does it also hold colder temperatures longer?
All right. Panel?
I'll take the second one first. As far as cities, the reason cities are usually hotter is because they're because of the pollution, the smog that's in there that keeps the heat in much more so even than the CO2. As far as CO2 retaining cold as well as heat, CO2 blocks or absorbs infrared effectively, and infrared is heat, so it shouldn't have much effect as far as the cold is concerned. What was the first question again?
Does burning itself add a significant amount of heat, or is the issue only about the absorption and retention of heat that comes only from the Earth and the sun?
Well, it comes from all sorts of sources. There's no question about that. I did an analysis a couple of years ago where I was looking at sunspot activity as a signature of the amount of heat coming from the sun over time. And if you do enough of averaging, it gives you effectively the same curve as you get from global warming over time. So a lot of past heat certainly came from the sun and the effect of that. But since about 1980, there's been a huge discrepancy between the two of them, so we have much more heat coming from other sources. So it's very possible it could be partially from volcanoes, it could be partially from human sources, it could be partially from the fact that there may be more clouds in the atmosphere. So there are all sorts of things that have to go in together. It makes it very, very difficult to say what actually is the cause one way or the other.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call, and I want to thank Jay in the car who emailed us a question, and frankly, we can't read it on the air, but it's hilarious. I'll pass it around to our scientist, and then we'll go on to the next caller at 1-800-348-2551. Lissa in Kingston. Lissa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I was curious about, I put, say, hamburgers into a plastic Ziploc into the freezer and take all the air out so I can get as much in there as I can. And every time I go into the freezer to get ice or something, the plastic bags have filled back up with air. Is it because the plastic is actually porous?
Wow.
We're all looking at each other.
Somebody say something or we'll go dead.
How do you remove the air from the plastic bag?
In other words, I'll just say I put in two hamburgers.
Right.
I will then put them in the Ziploc and then just fold the Ziploc over and over again until most of the air is out. And then just close up the Ziploc.
So you sort of lean on the bag until you've pressed out all the air. And
correct.
Okay.
And then it fills up again.
Well, yeah, next time I go in to get ice or whatever, the bag is filled with air again. It's all ballooned up.
Well, again, I hate to say that I've done this many, many times, but I have. And what I do is I'll take the Ziploc bag and put a straw in the end, suck all the air out of the bag, and then close it the rest of the way. And put that in the fridge. And months later, when I go back, there's still no air in it. So,
but that's the fridge. How about the freezer?
No, the freezer. Excuse me. I'm talking about the freezer. So
well,
my guess it has something to do with the lock of the Ziploc, that somehow it's getting in.
Or the hamburgers are alive.
Well, if they were, they'd be they're frozen alive, and I wouldn't eat them.
If I were in a totally different field, I'd ask the question, what brand of Ziploc do you use?
But this is public radio, Helmut, and we don't want to get involved with that.
Scratch that.
Well, I don't know.
Well, I think I'll have to take that one for homework. I will get some hamburger, and I will put it in a bag, and I will find out.
He actually does this, too. He'll do his homework.
I'm thinking
I love that.
Okay.
And it's not always just hamburger. I'm basically saying anything. It's usually meat we have in the freezer, but it's anything I put in the freezer. And then when I go back in again, every single one has filled up with air again. And I release the air, close it up real tight, and there's air in the bag again next time I go in the freezer.
Do you have a self-defrost on your freezer?
Possibly.
Do you have ice forming in your freezer when it's been left alone for a while, or does the thing
make
all
sorts of
noise?
Well, we have an ice machine in the freezer.
No, I'm just wondering, because if you have a defroster in your freezer, then that causes things actually to go above zero for a period of zero Celsius for a time and then go back down again.
Ah.
Yeah.
And that could cause the bag to expand. But that's the only thing I can think of.
Well,
offhand.
That's interesting. Yeah. Great question, Lisa. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.
I'll
have
let
a great
you know
day.
Next time.
You too. All right. Ed has some homework. Scott in Western Massachusetts. Scott,
Hi,
you're on.
Hamburger.
Hi there. You guys do such a great job every time. I always enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I had a question about the sun itself and solid mass that it expels that adds weight to our planet. I heard that on Radiolab recently, and I thought, well, how?
All right.
Well, you get things coming out of the sun called CMEs, which are
coronal mass ejections.
Thank you. And they are particles that come from the sun, and they enter the atmosphere, and they actually fall through the atmosphere to the Earth. So we do get that. We get about 11,000 tons of meteorite material per day coming in through the atmosphere. So the mass of the Earth is changing, but not so much that we're going to wind up spiraling into the sun as a result.
Oh, good.
Well, that's good to know, and I deeply appreciate the answer. That's fascinating to me. Thanks so much.
Yeah,
well,
thanks, Scott.
Something you might try, by the way, next time we have a meteor shower, put a thing of water outside with a plastic bag around it, and after the shower is over, go outside with take a magnet, put it in a plastic bag, put it inside, and you can actually collect particles that have come into the atmosphere from the meteors.
Really? And so is it a fairly uniform dusting that we get?
We get a pretty uniform dusting during meteor showers, yes.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
It's pretty cool.
Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Joseph in Stillwater. Joseph, you're up.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I am a mechanical engineering student at the University of Pennsylvania, and so I've been recently doing some stress testing on different materials, where basically we test the tensile stress, figure out where it's going to fail at, and we have different materials like cast iron and steel and stuff. And basically, when it breaks, with quite a few of the materials, it breaks exactly at a 45-degree angle. And I'm kind of curious why that is.
That's in compression or in tension?
Tension.
In tension, 45-degree angle.
Yes.
Have you ever looked at Griffith theory?
No.
Well, that's probably the first place to start. Most materials, when they break in tension, they break because there's microcracks in them.
Right.
And the microcracks form a stress field around them. That stress field then affects other microcracks, and they start to attach themselves to each other. So you get these little pointy spots at the end of small voids, if you want, in the material, microvoids. And those attract each other, and that can cause it to break at a 45-degree angle or other angles, but generally speaking, at that angle.
Is the material, completely isotropic or anisotropic? In other words, does it have the same consistency or density when you're looking in one direction as opposed to?
Yes, generally, they're supposed to, ideally, anyway.
Okay.
What kind of material is it?
We've done everything from cast iron to steel. It was for a research project I was doing for one of my classes.
Mm-hmm. I take it you didn't have it thinned in the center, right?
What?
Usually when you do tensile tests, it's fat at the ends and thinner in the center, so it breaks in the center.
Yes. Basically, it was like an I-shape.
Where, right.
Is that going to cause any temperature differences? Very minor, in other words? Okay.
No. If it's anything, it has to do with Griffith theory.
Griffith thing. Okay.
Yeah. Griffith, by the way, was a milkman who got involved with trying to figure out why it is that milk bottles would break in cold temperatures. And that was one of the things he found out. Usually, of course, it's going to break perpendicular to the direction of stress. So I'm not really sure why the 45, but that might be one of the main reasons.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Joseph. We appreciate the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Lynn in Shelburne. Hi, Lynn. You're up.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love this program.
Thank you.
I have a question about the Big Bang Theory. in
that. Not the TV show.
Huh?
Not the TV show, as you informed us.
I'm sorry.
No, not the TV show. No.
No.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, no. That's very funny. No, it's about, well, it's what happened before that, you know?
What happened before the Big Bang? Now we're getting somewhere.
Well, you know, years ago we thought the world was flat, and now we think that the Big Bang is the end of the, you know, the beginning of the world, and I'm not religious at all. Huh? But why would we even conceive of the fact that the Big Bang was the beginning?
Yeah, well, I think scientists have grappled with this, and philosophers as well. You can't really conceptualize infinity. But we'll throw it out to the scientists. Helen, you look like you have an idea.
Well, all I'm thinking is
you were here, weren't you?
Oh, ouch, Ed! Really?
I was talking to your grandparents.
I can understand.
It's all right, Lynn. They're fighting amongst themselves. Helen's going to answer your
question. No, I'm not going to answer it. But I'm thinking that we are primates. That we have brains that handle certain kinds of theories or certain kinds of images of how the world works. And one thing we can't conceive of easily is a time when something emerges out of nothing. And yeah. I don't know how we get around that because...
I don't know, but it's hard to hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She speaks very softly.
Yes.
I was saying the way we're set up, we have a difficulty because of the way our brains work,
yes.
I think,
yes.
in conceiving of a time when there was absolutely nothing because
yes.
we're not set up to... conceptualize.
I would like to also mention on the subject of brains that that's one of the leading suggestions of how the universe started, is that there are membranes in a fifth or sixth dimension that we can't even imagine what it is.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, these things move and they hit each other. And when they do, they send effectively sparks into the fourth dimension, the third dimension.
Okay.
And that's where we're at. So they're called brains.
But now, one thing that some scientists will say is, well, we can't really test the theory that there are fifth, sixth, eighth, 13th dimensions.
That's right.
So how does one then progress from a scientific standpoint to an idea like that?
Well, we see things happening in our dimensions, which can't be explained by what happens in our dimensions.
At this time.
There's a very good example. If you were to draw a picture of a face, for example, on mm-hmm. a piece of paper, then that face can only rotate in the plane of the paper. And if you lived in that plane of the paper, that's all you'd understand. But if you were to take that piece of paper now and flip it in a
yeah.
third dimension to the other side...
Then we're stupid.
Right. Then
it
would do something which is absolutely impossible.
Yes.
And that's what apparently is happening. We're discovering all sorts of things that are absolutely impossible. And the only way we can actually explain them is by saying that somebody in some other dimension is getting paid more than we are.
But now, getting back to Lynn's original question,
right.
And that was, what came before the Big Bang? There are those who say nothing. Nothing happened before the Big Bang. Well, let's have the scientists weigh in here.
Go ahead. No, I've already spoken, so you go ahead.
Well, I wanted, this doesn't answer, unfortunately, that question, but what struck me as I was listening to both of my colleagues is that we seem to be unable to design theories that are incongruent with, and I'll call
our
it the natural perception of the world. In other words, we have limits on, because we don't have sensory systems that can deal with infinity
yes.
or something beyond the Big Bang. And that does seem almost as though it limits the way even physicists and other theorists do look at the world. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I throw it out.
But at the same time, we do make observations, and every once in a while we come up with an observation which leads us to some conclusion. And as an example of that, in the case of the universe is expanding. We have some pretty good evidence that that's happening. But what's weird about the universe is that the density of material in the universe doesn't seem to be changing.
Yeah.
So normally when something expands, the distance between each particle changes. But what's happening in our universe is that as it expands, the density is staying about the same. So it's very possible, for example, and one way to explain that is to say that our universe is expanding into a universe that's already there.
Right.
And what we may actually be seeing is a series of universes like when you drop a rock in a puddle, you get waves. And each of those waves could be another universe moving out from the center.
But a universe is everything.
Well,
isn't it?
It's the everything that we are, that we have, but it doesn't mean
that we can imagine.
It doesn't mean everything that's out there. For example, we know that there's a boundary to our universe, but what's beyond that boundary, we don't know. And it's very possible it could be another universe. So the possibilities are there. We could talk for hours and hours and come up with nothing.
These sort of lava lamp moments are usually reserved for Astronomy with Bob Berman. We usually get into this sort of thing on the program and a lot of calls like this, and we place some Quicksilver Messenger service, and we all just sort of trip out here on the program. Hey, tell you what, let's take a break. It's the Science Forum, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Back with more interesting stuff, perhaps, coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. The Pirates Lakeside Grill on Nassau Lake, local organic grass-fed beef burgers, Milwaukee hot dogs, bison, and fish fry. Open Thursday through Sunday, noon to 8 p.m., PiratesLakesideGrill.com. Albany County Citizens Corps, recruiting emergency response volunteers for Albany County. Training and support provided, RegisteredAndReady.com. Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts. The Bang on a Can All-Stars performing David Lang's Death Speaks on July 26th. And the Bang on a Can Marathon featuring composer Steve Reich and Wilco's Glenn Cochi, August 2nd, massmocha.org. And the Montessori School of the Berkshires, working to foster independence in an experiential learning environment, rolling admissions for toddler program through 8th grade. BerkshireMontessori.org.
Hello again, everyone. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551. Ray Graff here. Ed Stander right across. Helmut Hirsch is here. Helen Giardella and you calling in or just listening in. Let's go to Tiffany. Tiffany, are you actually in New York City right now?
I was in New York City. I lied.
We're losing.
I'm on my way to Vermont.
Okay. Well, the signal isn't good, so let's hear what you have to say.
Well, I was going to ask a question about the number 7.
Yeah.
Another question came up.
All right.
How can there be clouds when it's freezing?
How can there be clouds when it's freezing?
They're made of ice particles. In fact, most clouds are made of ice particles because we're so high up in the sky. And when ice particles rub against ice particles, because they get really high up, then you get lightning. So that's basically what it's all about. Doesn't turn to rain until it gets to the surface of the Earth.
Are you still with us, Tiffany?
I guess okay, not.
Another,
okay.
Another satisfied customer.
I was wrong.
No.
Joyce in Newburgh. Joyce, you're on.
Hi. This is Joyce from Newburgh. Of course, you just said that. But anyway,
indeed.
I've got an answer for the gal who has the crease problem in her pants or whatever it is she's pressing.
Okay.
Okay.
It's vinegar. You just take a Q-tip, dip it in the vinegar, run it along the crease, and press it out, and it works.
So
the vinegar does...
Can we suggest that it's a pH issue here?
Well, it sounds like it. Do you re-iron it again then, or just let it?
No, you do have to press it out again,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you
but
using starch?
Just simply use the vinegar on it. For some reason, it does seem to relax the fibers a bit more, and it does come out. The only time you may have a problem is if it's a very old skirt and it's been washed and pressed, or anyway, any garment that's been pressed for many, many, many years. That would probably be a problem, but for something that's relatively current, you can get the crease out. I do it all the time.
You had a question, Ed.
No, I had two things. First of all, it explains why all my girlfriends smell like vinegar. But the other question I had was, does it make a difference if you're using starch or not?
If you're using starch?
Yeah.
Does anybody use starch these days?
Not too many people use starch at this point.
Okay, so then the answer is no.
Okay, good enough.
I don't know. I haven't tried that because generally there hasn't been starch in what I'm doing. It's quite often skirts or pants, and it's not, say, shirts perhaps. I don't starch shirts because I don't have a problem there.
Well,
But then what you could do is just rinse out the shirt again if you're pressing it.
Because what I'm thinking is that if the fibers have been locked together somehow by ironing, so that now they cannot unlock themselves and straighten out, the vinegar might be actually, most fabric that we iron is cotton-based.
And the
vinegar may be swelling them or unswelling them or changing their conformation in such a way that we can now get it back to some...
That's from what I understand from chatting with other people who do this kind of thing. Yeah, that seems to be what happens.
Okay.
But does it happen with polyester as well?
Ah, good question. Natural fibers only?
Well, that doesn't necessarily...
I have done it with polyester.
Doesn't necessarily. It would depend on the individual fiber.
So now I have to buy hamburger meat and vinegar. But
okay,
that's okay.
Joyce,
I'll go for it.
Thank you.
Hamburger meat and vinegar.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Old Tom Waits album, I think.
Yes,
hamburger
it was.
Meat and vinegar. All right, let's go to Elizabeth in Kingston. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
You're on.
Yeah. I'm coming up second, I guess, because I have a solution to the ironing problem, too.
Okay.
Uh-huh. It's more simply, and I think with vinegar you have to be careful because it could discolor some fabrics.
Yeah.
Even if you're using white. Just use water. Return the crease to its original state. Get it thoroughly wet, and then re-iron it.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the answer, but it doesn't quite answer the question, which is why does it happen in the first place?
Okay, I still can't hear you.
Helen wants to know why does it happen in the first place?
No, I'm just congratulating.
Why does it happen in the first place?
Yeah.
Well, you mean why can't you get it out in the first place?
Well, the idea was that once you have pressed it, it stays pressed, and you can't press it.
Okay, translate, please.
Okay.
She said that when you press it and you get a crease and you try to iron it out, you can't iron it out.
Okay,
and
I'm sorry. I'm not
going
to take up your time, but I cannot hear
you. Well, we're obviously having a little trouble with the send, and I apologize, Elizabeth, and... You are listening to the Laundry and Ironing Forum, and let's go to line 3 and talk to Mary in Rhinebeck. Mary, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hello.
And hi, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Yes, I can. Okay, now this time of year, one loves to buy peaches, and I've bought them for years from the greengrocer. And in the past, it seems to me, I would bring them home, put them on the counter, and the next morning... There would be tiny fruit flies. This was, spontaneous. We all know it isn't spontaneous, but they would appear. But now, this year, for instance, there aren't any fruit flies appearing after the peaches stand on the counter. And I wondered, might this be because of irradiation or
pesticides?
Go ahead, Helen.
I wouldn't necessarily think of radiation. What I have a very uncomfortable feeling as I listen to you, which is perhaps that they've started to use some kind of a different pesticide or even, that water they use to make it look like the vegetables and fruits are being exposed to the rain. They may be putting something on them that has an influence. And I just have a crazy thought, which might be that go to a farmer's market, where you're buying things somewhat more directly from the source, and take some peaches from a supermarket. Don't put them too close together and see, does one of them attract fruit flies when the other one does not? And then the next step might be, unfortunately, to go to the supermarket and say, okay, you're obviously putting something on the fruit. What is it?
But the process of irradiation, I'm not quite clear what that does actually to food. I know it's quite controversial.
Well, I would imagine it kills anything living on the fruit. I suppose if your fruit had been out somewhere and fruit flies had a chance to lay eggs in the fruit, and then if they're irradiated after that, and then sent to your home pretty quickly, no new fruit flies would have a chance to lay their eggs. But you'd have to know when they irradiate it, because my guess is they don't do it in the grocery store.
No, I wouldn't think in this grocery store at all. I know for sure, but I'm surprised.
There's another possibility as well, and that's that the fruit flies are in your house. and flying around the food. And it may be that you just happen to have less fruit flies in your house this year than you had last year, and possibly because the weather's been so cold. It could be any number of reasons.
Interesting. Well, that's a great call. I would assume, Helmut, that if there is pesticide spraying, it is done at the source before it gets to the store.
I don't know. I mean, they put wax on apples much later than they don't put the wax on when they pick them.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, we've had some very fascinating calls today. Let's go to D in Lake George. D, you're on.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Hopefully you can hear us.
Yes, we can. We live on the east side of Lake George, about 7 miles or 8 miles north of the village. And this past year, my adult daughter was home visiting, and she and my husband stayed outside very late, and they had a fire in the fireplace, and I looked up in the sky, and over the water, there was a very tall light, but it was very high up in the sky, and it had an erratic behavior. It would go in one direction, and then my daughter described it as behaving like a water bug. It would squiggle around and then change directions very quickly. And we don't believe in UFOs in our family, but this was the next morning. It was the topic of conversation, and unfortunately, only two of us saw this light, and the rest of us just heard about it. And I thought perhaps it might be a drone, but they said that they felt it was too high up for a drone or a laser, but it wasn't connected to the ground. Would you have any idea what it is?
Well, as far as the laser goes, if there were clouds in the sky, then you might not see the beam, but you'd see the reflection on the clouds. Drones, on the other hand, can go up very, very high, right. And so can weather balloons. Things like that show up all the time.
But if something... Go ahead.
But that... Yes, go
on. The drones make... They said the length of the light was about as tall as a tall tree, you know, like a maple tree. It was a very long light.
Then that could easily have been a laser light in a cloud bank or something like that.
But who would have laser in the middle of the lake? It was over the water.
Me.
Yeah, that sounds like something Ed would do. How long were they watching it, Dee?
Oh, for half an hour. And they finally gave up and came inside. Now, I have to say my daughter was drinking wine, but my husband was totally sober. And after a half hour, they decided to go inside because it just didn't quit. And I do have to say that somebody on our road has started up a business with a drone for real estate companies to take aerial photographs of homes on the lake that are for sale. But they did say that the drone was that it was a very high up light.
Yeah, well, I would probably go for the laser. You can buy 1-watt lasers now for $150 coming out of China. And these things, when they hit anything in the atmosphere, they can produce a beam that goes for miles.
And there's a real problem because of
they shoot
pilots.
Down planes.
Well,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Pilots will be blinded.
And I'm thinking.
I know. I'm aware of that.
If there were a camp or a celebration or a birthday party or something like that.
Half an hour? Was it a green light just by chance?
No, it was a white light.
A white light?
It was a white light.
Well, then it probably wasn't a laser. But I can't think of what it might have been.
Well, they can't either. And we're still talking about it.
Cool.
We haven't seen it since.
Hmm. Well, that's a great call. When did this happen?
On a Saturday or Sunday night of the last weekend in June.
Okay. Well, if we hear of any more, we will certainly report. Dee, thanks a lot. And let's go to Alec on Route 90 near Albany. Alec, you're on. Are you still with us?
I am.
You're on.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to discuss the freezer situation and the loss of vacuum in bags.
Okay.
And so, you know, what happens is that when you take the air out of the bag, you have created a pressure gradient across the plastic.
Okay.
There are certain bags that are designed to maintain that pressure gradient, and those are vacuum bags, and they're specifically, they have a vacuum, a port through which you evacuate the air. And they will tend to hold, pretty confidently hold the vacuum. Other bags are really not designed for that, and they will slowly leak. probably through the seal.
Do you think it might be a change in barometric pressure that leads to the change in size of them?
I think the there could be a change in barometric pressure, but remember that you're putting it into the freezer with a pressure gradient already present. I mean, you've created, when you're pulling the air out of it, a pressure gradient.
Sure.
You have more pressure outside than in, so the air wants to go in, and if there's the slightest leak over time, also plastic becomes more brittle, which would intend to exacerbate a leak in the seal.
Okay.
So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, with regard to the frost-free freezer and how it removes frost, I don't believe it's true that it goes above freezing for a period of time and then and defrost that way. It's more, it's much more likely due to sublimation of very fine ice crystals.
Yeah.
You'll note that there's a fan going on in that freezer a lot of the time.
Sure. I've checked both, and I've actually put thermometers in frost freeze, and they do go above zero for a period of time. But whether that has any effect or not, I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, it would be interesting to see, because if it goes above freezing, then once it goes below freezing, if you haven't successfully evaporated all the ice, you're going to find pools of not just the fine crystals, but actual clear ice with more volume.
Okay. Well, Alec, great call, and we appreciate you weighing in here. Let's try to get a couple of more calls in on the Science Forum. Dylan and Ariskina, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm an engineering student, and I just finished a course in electricity and magnetism. And from the beginning, we worked with two numbers governing vacuum permittivity and magnetic permittivity, notated as epsilon naught and mu naught in Greek letters. These two numbers come up to eventually define the speed of light in its definition equation. I'm just curious, though, they never really described what they are. Epsilon naught pertains to each of the Maxwell equations and governing electricity, and mu naught pertains to each of Maxwell's equations governing magnetism or magnetic permittivity. But I just don't know. I never got a total explanation of what they are.
Well, I can tell you that I went through my physics class before those were even invented. So it would be really hard for me to tell. And I'm probably the closest person here to be able to say something about it. So you may have to wait till the next science forum and stump them with it.
Anybody else want to weigh in?
No, I can't.
Wow. Hey, Dylan, excellent job. You have stumped the band. You win our prize, which is exactly nothing. But well done.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot for the call. Andy in Albany. Andy, you're up.
Hi. Having been through that big lightning storm the other day, and then I was reading an article in one of the science magazines about lightning and how much electricity and heat that it gives off, I was wondering what the science is. You don't hear people talking about harnessing that for, you know, a green source of energy production. I was just wondering what the science is behind that, why people are not harnessing electricity to make power.
Well, one of the reasons is that it's rather uncertain where it's going to hit at any one time. So it's sort of difficult to say, oh, well, I'm going to put up a kite with a key on it and harness the electricity, when it's very possible the electricity is not going to hit at that spot. So that's the first problem. The second problem is one of amperage versus voltage. It's extremely high voltage, and in the case of lightning, it's also high amperage, but very short duration. So it's very, very difficult to be able to harness that stuff and put it in anything. And thirdly, there's a lot of better sources of electricity around and a lot cheaper and a lot more certain. I mean, I hate to think that to get my air conditioning running, I had to wait for a lightning storm
right
to come by.
I mean, it worked for Dr. Frankenstein.
But that was about it, and only for a couple seconds.
Well, Andy, that's a great question, and we appreciate it. I think we have time. We don't have time. I apologize to Jake in Latham. Jake had a question about scientific reason, or research, I should say. And frankly, I think we have to wrap it up. So, Helen, you want to say anything?
Well, just wish everybody a happy evening and on into the future.
Helmut Hirsch.
Well, and also people living around Lake George, keep an eye out for that light phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I guess call back.
That would be great. We love to hear about that stuff. Ed Stander.
Get it on your camera phone if you pass it.
Right. Anybody who has an extra pound of hamburger and like to donate to the cause, just let me know.
Okay, so support comes from Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities, open 7 days a week. YeOldWarwickBookshop.com. Washington County Tourism, featuring cultural activities throughout Washington County, including museums, historic sites, trails, talks, and presentations, WashingtonNYCounty.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, HenyonBakery.com. And Global Renaissance Perspective, Saratoga Springs, New York, announcing a grant-funded kindergarten Chinese immersion program in the Saratoga State Park starting in August. GlobeKindergarten.org for registration. Well, what a great show, and thank you for being part of it at home and calling in with your great questions. Thanks to our panel, Ed Stander, Helmut Hirsch, and Helen Giardella. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our hearty control room operator, and Anonymous Sandy answered the calls. Thanks to our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Remember, you can take WAMC with you. Download our new mobile app for streaming audio, headlines, podcasts, and more. Just go to the iTunes or Google Play App Store. Search WAMC Mixer and enjoy. Tomorrow, it's Food Friday tomorrow. We'll see you then.